Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston, and it's our Week in Review, starting with the ban on medical marijuana vape products, which is set to lift Tuesday.
The ultimate goal was to make sure that medical marijuana patients were able to get their medicine.
Also, we'll talk about the retirement of State Police Chief Kerry Gilpin and dig into local election results.
Finally, the City Council's governance body is reflecting the diversity that exists in Boston. So I think that is pretty amazing.
And we visit Old North Church, which recently discovered that some of its early members were slave traders.
I think that our commitment to being unafraid to look ugliness in the eye has in some ways given us courage.
We'll take your calls next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, so it's our Week in Review. Let's dive right in. A lot happened in the world of marijuana, vaping, and cigarettes this week. First, the ban on medical marijuana vape products is set to lift on Tuesday, barring some court injunction or a quarantine order from the CCC or the Cannabis Control Commission. Here's Marion McNabb, CEO of the Cannabis Community Care and Research Network, a Worcester-based cannabis advocacy and research group.
It would be a win for the industry here to have medical vapes back on the market.
This comes after a third death in Massachusetts related to vaping. Here's Governor Charlie Baker.
For me, the whole thing is terribly troubling because we haven't been able to secure an answer from any of these state and federal agencies that are looking into this yet that makes it possible for us to say to the public, this is the answer. Don't do this, okay?
Meanwhile, the U.S. Attorney's Office is reported to be looking into municipal marijuana contracts. And convenience store owners went on strike to protest another proposed ban, this time on flavored tobacco products like menthol. John Scher with the New England Convenience Store and Energy Marketers Association says a ban would devastate these stores.
It has a significant impact on the revenue. These customers that come in, these adult customers that come in now, are among their most loyal. And when they come in, they're not just buying those tobacco products, but they're buying all the other ancillary products.
Joining me now is Susan Tracy. She's a Democratic strategist and president of the Strategy Group. She's also working with tobacco-free kids in support of a flavor ban on nicotine products. Susan, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Also with us this week is Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate. Great to see you, Richard.
Happy to be back.
And you are with us. We hope you'll pull up a seat to the table. Give us a call. What do you think of the governor's vaping ban? Do you think medical marijuana should be excluded from that ban? And should the state consider banning flavored tobacco products? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So let's get into this. Let's start. Unless the CCC decides on a quarantine of marijuana vaping products, things like oil cartridges, for example, or there's some other court ruling, medical marijuana vape products back on store shelves by next Tuesday. This comes after a judge ruled that the vaping ban the governor put in place could not apply to medical marijuana vapes unless the Cannabis Control Commission decided that it should because they're in charge of cannabis. Your reaction, is that a good thing, Richard?
I think it's a legal issue, and clearly the bill that allowed for medical marijuana in the state of Massachusetts gave that authority to the commission, and the judge rightly saw that. So it is really up to the commission to make that decision.
So it really shouldn't have been covered by the ban in the first place.
There are some people who have looked at this ban, and there are a lot of different parts of the ban that they don't feel the governor is on solid legal ground. I know there are a number of different cases swirling around right now. This is the first that's been decided. But again, medical marijuana has always been treated differently, Aaron, before recreational. He's got to go by the law.
So Governor Baker has said that we still don't know what's causing the deaths that have been happening. The man who died earlier this week was in his 50s. He had smoked both nicotine vape products and marijuana products made with THC. Here's more of what Governor Baker said.
But we did it because we thought we needed a pause until we had more information. And my hope here is that as this body of evidence continues to grow, we're going to get answers to the question I think is on everybody's mind, which is exactly what is it that's causing this and what is it that people need to do to assure that they are not putting themselves at risk when they vape.
Susan, do you think people who use medical marijuana products should still be cautious, even if those products, vaping products, go back on the shelves next Tuesday?
Well, I'm going to differ a little bit with Richard in terms of it's a legal issue. I get that. But it's a public health issue. I mean, you do have people dying. You have people getting sick. And I think the governor's right on this one, which is, you know, as someone who is in charge of the public health of the Commonwealth, until you know what's causing it, I hear you in terms of adults and medical marijuana is legal and people can do what they want. I get you. I get that. But I do understand the perspective of trying to make the right choices for public health for the Commonwealth. And that includes kids and adults. And so I give him credit for taking a hard stand on something that I think legally might be a little weak or might be on, you know, unsure footing. But I think he's trying to do the right thing.
He has to be on have the statutory authority to do it. But I would point out on my way here today, the CDC just came out literally about an hour ago and said that on a lot of the cases on the deaths, so 29 around the country, that they examined the tissues and they found out that it was vitamin E oil that's contributing. It's a common,
it does seem to be the thing they're now saying they're targeting is vitamin E oil.
Yeah, and it might not be the only thing, but it's the thing that's in common that they just came out with today that's in all of the cases. So hopefully we're getting closer to figuring out what's going on here.
Let's take a call, actually. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kathy from Canton, have a seat at the table.
Oh, thank you. I wanted to say that finding the cause is not a managerial issue in the 4 months of the ban. Science finds answers in an unpredictable fashion, and that Governor Baker has said we should find the solution, and it will take an unknown amount of time.
I want to build on that too, Kathy. Thank you, because we have also heard when we've covered this on previous shows, people saying, and please keep in mind that we don't have long-term data on vaping products either, and really don't have any sense either way if there are long-term effects of vaping. Susan and Richard, in the conversation you just had, it raised something that I've been thinking a lot about in this area, which is how does a responsible government manage the competing claims between public health concerns and statutory obligations? Does one ever trump the other, or are we simply in a situation where this is just hard because you do have those competing claims?
I'd say one, it is both of those things. It is hard, you're right. But in my mind, public health and life would trump law and statute for me. I'm not saying that you can, you know, just completely do whatever you want and run over things. But I think for Governor Baker right now, and remember, this was a four-month ban. He said, let's take a pause. Let's try to understand this better. Let's try to see if we can figure out what's happening before we just kind of, let's instead of keep going along with a system that we know is not working at the moment. So I give him credit. It's risky. It's hard. I know people will kind of come at you on it. But I think he put life and public health and kids first.
Richard, what do you think?
He's trying to do the right thing, but you have to follow the law. And in this case, the judge determined that he didn't have the statutory ability, at least as far as medical marijuana goes. The legislature clearly left that up to the commission. Now, if you know, the commission has a responsibility, if there's a public health crisis, to vote You know, they could have very easily at their last meeting voted to extend the ban themselves. But, you know, that said, I do think that you have science is a lot to do with this. And the CDC is looking at this right now. You know, they have determined that almost all of the cases that have come up have been because of, you know, they've been dealing with marijuana, but not from legal products. They're products that have been purchased off the street or from relatives or, you know, just not that haven't gone through the safety process. They're not being bought in a vape shop. And that seems to be, you know, a good portion of this.
Yeah, a large portion seem to be, let me not dive into that because I was going to recount the data, but I had that moment of panic where I don't want to get it wrong. There are deaths of both kinds, and causality is still something that's up in the air. Let's take another call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Phil from Newton, you're on the line. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm a former smoker. About 3 years ago, I quit cigarettes and started vaping because my kids suggested it. And I think that the vaping ban is a ridiculous overreaction. My feeling is that the number of people that have been harmed, although that's always serious, is extremely small compared to the people that have been harmed in the same period, I would guess, by things that are still legal, like cigarettes, alcohol. When the vape ban was announced, I thought to myself, well, thank God I can't vape now, but I can go back to those healthful cigarettes that are still available in every corner store in Massachusetts.
So, Phil, is your objection to this as like at a public policy level or at the level of somebody who lost access to a product? Do you understand my question?
I do. I think it's really both. I mean, I certainly think the government has a responsibility to protect people, but I just feel as if my understanding is that two people have died in Massachusetts.
Three now.
Well, that's still that's much less than people that have died from a whole bunch of other things that have not been banned.
All right, Phil, thanks. I'm going to take it back to our panelists from their reactions to what Phil had to say.
You know, Phil's not wrong. I definitely understand where he's coming from as someone who uses a product, feels like it helps him. I get it. Three deaths is three deaths too many. And I do think the governor is trying to understand what the problem is before he says this is a safe product. And so, it's not perfect, but I think he's trying. I really do.
So the Cannabis Control Commission has a number of options available to itself now, too, Richard, and they have not taken away the potential that they might quarantine a product, for example, an oil-based cartridge. Here is Steve Hoffman. He's the head of the commission on 25 News.
We will begin a regulatory process to look at vaping products and to determine whether we need to make any changes to our regulations with respect to vaping products.
Do you expect that we'll see changes from the Cannabis Control Commission? Any thought about that?
It's kind of ironic that the last time we were here, this came up and the governor had just instituted his ban. And on the very same day the governor instituted his ban, the commission voted to create pot cafes in Massachusetts and voted to allow home delivery of marijuana. Who knows what they're going to end up doing? I mean, they're an agency that's obviously, I don't think the public health is necessarily
what's driving them.
It's more creating a
more
new
their
industry
regulatory responsibilities. And Susan, that does raise the question. This entire conversation about what's gone down this week has been around medical marijuana vaping because that was the focus of what was brought before the judge.
Yeah.
It does, of course, beg the question about recreational marijuana vaping and should it exclusively be under the control of the Cannabis Control Commission as well? Should we expect to see that coming down the pike now?
My guess would be the Cannabis Control Commission will try to control as much as they can. I mean, they're going to see that as their purview. But I still go back to the fundamental question is trying to understand that the role that vaping and vapes play in public health. And I feel like that is a driving question.
All right. Let's take one other call on this, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join our conversation on Week in Review. Pat from Watertown, pull up a seat. What's on your mind?
Thank you. The government's failure here, in my mind, started when there was lax regulation of these products when they first, you know, I first started seeing the friends using them 5-6 years ago. And there was no, you know, long-term studies. There was not the kind of data collected. It's not that different in my mind than what happened with the Boeing planes, that, you know, the foxes ran the hen house and now we're living with the consequences.
Yeah, Pat, I got to admit that the tie between marijuana vaping and Boeing planes was not something I was I was expecting there. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that was all I had to say.
All right. Well, Richard was nodding as you were talking, so let me turn to you on that, Richard.
I don't think that – I mean, there's – I think it's fair to criticize the FDA for not – for allowing these products to get on the market. And a lot of people feel as though that there weren't enough studies and there wasn't enough due diligence that was undertaken before they came on. So, I kind of agree with what the caller is saying right now.
Yeah. So now let's turn to the machinations of the legalization process, because while all of this has been going on this week, the Boston Globe reported that U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling's office is looking into municipal marijuana contracts. These are these host community agreements between marijuana businesses and the communities in which they wish to open. Critics in the industry have said for a while that local governments have too much power. Remember, Fall River Mayor, soon to be former Fall River Mayor Jaisal Correa was indicted for allegedly conspiring to extort more than $60,000 in bribes himself from four marijuana vendors. Excuse me, $600,000 from four marijuana. There is a difference with that extra zero. Here's Taba Moses of Green Soul Organics, who says he's not surprised that these agreements might wind up investigated.
I think it goes to show that a lot of people in the industry feel as though they can pay to play. There's a lot of politics involved, and there's a lot of people that have known each other for a long time. And then I think money and entitlement ends up coming into place.
Susan, good thing if the U.S. Attorney's Office is doing this?
Well, the U.S. attorney certainly knows how to pick his issues, doesn't he? He knows how to find the hot-button issues that get a lot of attention. Not surprising, especially on the heels of what he has investigated. In particular, I think, the issue at Boston City Hall with the zoning board, I think it kind of naturally leads to some questions about how are permits given, how are they denied, who's involved. And it is a little bit of sort of the Wild West out there in terms of, you know, the city by town approval process with not a lot of guardrails on how it runs. So kind of not surprising, given what we've seen from the U.S. attorney, that this is something that's caught his eye.
Richard, go ahead.
I was going to say the system's set up right now so the mayor, somebody like the mayor of Fall River, who is corrupt, can take advantage of it. Pretty easily. I mean, if you're at a municipality with a mayor, the mayor ultimately is the one at the end of the day who either has to give a letter of approval or a letter of non-opposition in order for a project to move on to the final stage. And then you have, you know, the requirements that are in the law right now. There are two requirements that, the only two really are that the contract can only be 5 years with the vendor and that no more than 3% of the gross revenue from the facility can be taxed as part of the host agreement. But what you do is you have a lot of cities and towns that are sort of adding things on, you know.
Yeah, I want to read this to your point. This is Shailene Teitel in a statement. She's a cannabis control commissioner. And she said, quote, "Just yesterday I received a complaint from a business that a town told the company representatives that only businesses who offered a donation of $15,000 would be considered. When they suggested they would rather not voluntarily donate, they say they were told, quote, perhaps this isn't the right town for you, end of quote." I mean,
exactly.
Richard.
Local officials, you know, they have to have that host agreement negotiated with the vendor. And it's not just that. There might be a new field. Like, we call it linkage when it comes up with housing. But there might be a new field that needs to be done. One of the select people in some of these small towns might have an agenda that they want to see money put into. There's a lot of things that I'm sure that that's what the U.S. attorney is investigating right now.
Okay, before we go to break, I do want to talk about, you know, there was the convenience store strike this week. There is a new proposed ban on flavored tobacco products, which could include menthol cigarettes. Susan, we have said you're working with Tobacco-Free Kids in support of a flavor ban on nicotine products. Why do you think this kind of the kind of ban that we have on vaping products should extend to things like flavored cigarettes?
Well, flavored cigarettes in particular, you know, menthol included, are actively marketed to kids, even though they say they're not, and actively marketed in particular with menthol to the minority community. So these, you know, these products are cause major health problems, result in millions and millions of dollars in cost to our health system, and they're getting kids addicted. So they play a really important role. Again, I'll go back to public health, kids addiction, in particular the minority community.
Richard, do you have a response on that?
Totally, with Susan on the children's part, and maybe it's an age requirement or more strict penalties. But for adults, when I did smoke, I smoked menthol cigarettes. Just ban tobacco. I mean,
are you advocating a tobacco ban?
No, I'm just saying, what's the difference between a menthol cigarette for an adult and a regular? There's no health study that shows that there's any difference. And the ultimate goal is to ban tobacco, that a lot of these people were pushing these individual, they're nibbling around the edges right now. And it's, you got this vaping crisis going on, you have people coming in around the periphery trying to take advantage of it to move their own agenda forward. And I think that that's what's happening with the, so we should have an honest conversation and just ban tobacco rather than, all these one-offs.
Okay.
If that's the case.
I got to move us on to a break here. I'd like you both, don't walk away anywhere. Stay here because we got more to talk about. Listeners, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to dig into local election results. We want you to call 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, so we are going to stick with that week in review. Tuesday was Election Day across the Commonwealth and across the country. Here in Boston, we had historic change for the city council.
Starting in January, you're going to have a council that will have 8 women on it and 7 councilors of color. That's the most ever.
In Fall River, relief at last from the ongoing scandals surrounding former Mayor Jaisal Correa.
Our next mayor, Mr. Paul Coogan. Let's hear it.
And in the national results, do we see a trend?
Virginia is officially blue. Congratulations.
That's Virginia Governor Ralph Northam pointing out the Democrats now control both bodies of the Virginia state legislature for the first time in more than 20 years. We still have our Week in Review panel here in Studio 3 to break it all down. Richard Tessay, former minority leader in the Massachusetts State Senate, thanks for staying with us. Great. And Susan Tracy, Democratic strategist and president of the Strategy Group. She's also working with tobacco-free kids in support of a flavor ban on nicotine products. Thanks for staying with us.
Sure.
And you, stay with us and call. We've got room at the table for you. What do you make of the election results in your town? What's important to you that happened on Tuesday? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Okay, Susan, what was your biggest takeaway from Tuesday's election results?
The Boston results, are something that I pay the most attention to. And one of the things that I found striking was, a couple of years ago when Ayanna Pressley won against Mike Capuano, I think we were all sort of like, wow. And not only did she win, she won big. And I feel like that Pressley race opened the door for a couple of things. For people who thought they couldn't win to feel like maybe I can. And it invited more people, I think, into the political arena who never thought they would be able to win. I also think it got voters who thought that kind of a candidate's never going to win to realize they can. And it energized their vote. And I think you saw that kind of growth from Ayanna's race coming through in the Boston City Council race.
Yeah, here's Marie St. Fleur, a former state representative, sure, reacting to the results on Radio Boston earlier this week.
For me, it's energized our democracy. I mean, that's what happened yesterday. If you think of Boston being a majority minority city, and it's been that, I think, for close to 10 years, if not more. And finally, the city council is governance body is reflecting the diversity that exists in Boston. So I think that is pretty amazing.
Richard, what does this mean for Boston?
I kind of look at it the same way. I mean, I think that this is great that people are getting involved in the electoral process. I think that the government was lagging behind in the way, in the faces and the way it was represented, because it is a minority city right now. So having all these new people, I think, is very, very healthy. I think the stage is set for the next election. I mean, this change has happened really quickly within two election cycles. And the next mayor's race, I think you're going to see.
What do you mean about the next mayor's race?
I think Councilor Wu, obviously, is
that's what I was wondering.
Really built a profile for herself. And whether it's her or somebody else, you're going to see, you know, the progressive wing of the party that's really the huge winner on Tuesday have a candidate, and it's and again we'll see how much the you know the change keeps on rolling. The other thing, if I could just mention, there are a lot of close races. There was obviously one here in Boston, 10 votes was the difference. But if you
Julia
look,
Julia Mejia and Alejandra St. Guillen
for that other council seat, you know, Don Humison won in Westfield by 97 votes. The Braintree race was decided by 140 votes. The Amesbury was 157. Just a lot of close races around.
What does that mean, Richard?
The state just that means that every vote does count, and there are a lot of people who don't think that. You know, there was a alderman's race in Melrose, 4 votes
was the
difference. And you know, the one thing I would say, it was an exciting election. I think if you're looking at the results, but I think it's important to keep in mind only 16%, 16.5% of the people in Boston bothered to show up and vote.
We have
83 people sat on the sidelines and just watched.
Yeah, we have a caller about that. Actually, Dave from Brookline, pull up a seat at the table.
Hi. So that was my point. Is it really change if only 60% of the electorate vote? Now, I'm guessing when we have Wu versus Walsh next year, it'll be a larger percentage of that. And then we'll truly see if the city's changed that much.
Dave, you believe Wu will run?
I can't see her not. I mean, everything she's done, short of getting picked by Elizabeth Warren, who gets if she gets elected president to work for her, I'm guessing that she's going to run.
What was your other point, Dave?
I was just going to say, there's, you know, even though we have all this diversity of color and gender, we don't have much diversity of thought in the city council. I mean, they pretty much all think the same way. So we'll see what happens. They still don't have a lot of power, even though that's supposed to be the hot place to be. They still are the Boston City Council with really little power compared to the mayor.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Sue, let me give you a chance to respond, and then Richard will add. Well, do you mind me deferring to Richard?
Go for it, Richard.
I was just going to say he's right. I mean, it's a very super diverse council, historically diverse, but philosophically there's no diversity. It's a very progressive, probably the most progressive, liberal city council that in the history of Boston. And the only conservative voice was Althea Garrison, who is diverse in her own right, but she came in seventh. You know, so it's everybody's going to be kind
Susan
of.
Susan does not look like she agrees with
well,
you.
Well, I mean, there are, you know, 9 city councilors who are elected at the district level. So, you know, you can say that they're all like the same people, but they come from very distinct parts of the city and have different perspectives as a result that are representative of where they're from.
At the same time, there is no hardcore conservative on that city council.
You know, I there probably are a couple who I wouldn't say their name because they probably would say, well, I'm not a hardcore conservative. But yes, there's a little bit of diversity there, certainly. But the one thing I would say, you know, where the gentleman who called talked about there's still no power on the city council. And to some extent, that's true. We have a strong mayor city. I mean, it is a strong mayor city. But I will say that the city council plays a really important role in raising issues and in kind of forcing the hand of government. And I think they've done that, whether it's on, you know, whether or not you agree with the positions that are taken is another matter. But, you know, it's things from Airbnb regulation, Uber and Lyft, bikes.
Housing is going to be a huge issue and whether or not, you know, Boston moves towards rent control or.
Right. But that council does push issues and kind of create a dynamic for change.
Richard, it's also apparently become a launching pad for other kinds of higher office. Do you think that's going to change who comes through and runs for city council seats?
Well, definitely. We talked about Congressman Presley, and she really made the city council
her
springboard, and I think a lot of people are interested. And just to backtrack on what I said a minute ago, you know, with the winner goes the spoils. And obviously the progressive groups in Boston were energized, and they're the ones who showed up, and they're the ones who won the races fair and square. So unless, you know, if people have different points of view, they have to get out there and they have to participate.
Absolutely.
All right. I want to get one more question in on elections before we move on. I don't want to miss Fall River, where there was a changing of hands. Will Fall River put the Jaisal Correa chapter behind it now?
Oh, boy, I hope so. And I hope I would think that they would hope so. You know, I think that no community wants to be under that kind of cloud.
And it's such a young age to be so brazenly corrupt.
Yeah.
It's just it's breathtaking. Stunning. Yeah.
OK, let's go on to our final topic for the week. Massachusetts State Police Superintendent Colonel Carrie Gilpin announced she's retiring effective a week from today. She served as head of the agency for the past 2 years, assuming the role in the midst of the Troop E overtime scandal. Governor Baker on Wednesday congratulated Colonel Gilpin on the reforms she made to the agency, but said that more needs to be done.
There's a ton of reform work that still remains to be done. And I think it's got to be somebody who gets that there's a lot of work that still remains to deal with a number of issues, administrative and otherwise, that are associated with the state police.
And listeners, if you want to join this conversation, what do you think needs to be done next with the state police? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you make of Colonel Gilpin stepping down at this moment?
You know, I don't know about the moment per se, but, you know, I'm not surprised. There's just been scandal after scandal after scandal. And, you know, it's I think it becomes hard to continue to lead an organization under that cloud. So, you know, the day and the date and how quickly it happened, I don't have a comment on that. That it did happen does not surprise me.
Richard, with so many scandals and such an what appears to be historically entrenched culture in the state police, was 2 years enough for anybody to be able to turn things around? Or was that more than enough time and Colonel Gilpin just wasn't getting the traction that's necessary in that leadership role?
Well, I think the Colonel has a lot of supporters. She did do a lot of good things while she was there. But the situation is so bad. The culture is so bad there. The problems are so, you know, have been around for a long time that you really do need a particular type of leader. And everybody has a different leadership style. I think she would have been great maybe 10 years ago or at another time. I think right now they really need a vocal person who goes in there, who takes charge, you know, and gives the public confidence that the agency's on the right track and improves the morale of the troopers themselves. There are 2,100 people there. Most of them are really good people, and they're just looking
Absolutely.
At what's happened to this agency. And
you think they're demoralized.
It's outrageous. Demoralized. Yeah, so I don't think she was the right person for the right time, and I hope that the governor, you know, and the whole thing was, I mean, she kind of got the position because the whole chain of command, if you remember, to Trooper Gate back when the colonel or the judge's daughter got in trouble.
Oh, yes.
And
Richard McKeon.
Yeah,
and not only did he leave, but his assistant left. There was a whole void in the
I want to pick up on that. And Susan, because to Richard's point, we also now were reminded this week by the Boston Globe and actually by a tweet from Tom Nolan, who's a former Boston police lieutenant, that state law actually requires that the chief of the state police be someone from inside the state police. Is it time to change that?
You know, it's funny. I found myself thinking about that when I read it as well. As, of course, it's time to change that. And I found myself thinking, Ed Davis, beloved. He came from Lowell. He didn't come from Boston.
Former Boston Police
Commissioner.
Boston
Police Commissioner. Bill Bratton, New York, Los Angeles. Didn't come up the ranks. Kathy O'Toole, I believe, went off to Belfast or Ireland.
And, she is in Ireland.
And,
former
right.
Boston Police Commissioner.
Paul Evans left here and went to London, I believe. So you don't need to be from the ranks to do a good job to bring respect to the agency and get the respect of the forces within the agency.
All right. And I guess the last question that I have on this is with this much history, with the scandals that have broken, with the deeply entrenched culture, will it take someone with a different kind of vision as well? Or should it be somebody who's focused like a laser beam on the list of reforms that's sort of currently in place? Richard, let me give you last word on that.
I think you need a leader who can really get in there again and be vocal and you know, and speak out against some of these things that have happened, restore the public trust and restore the morale.
Absolutely. I think that's dead on, those two points. Restore the public trust and restore morale.
All right. That's a good place to turn our attention to our hubbubs, which are those short stories or events that might not have trended on Twitter this week or in your other feeds, but that caught our attention. Richard, let me start with you.
I have a sort of a hodgepodge of things. First of all, it's bye week for the Patriots. So everybody's like...
I think everyone already knows that one.
They're like, what am I going to do this weekend?
Nothing to do, huh?
People who are just... their whole weekend's around the Patriots. So it's Veterans Day weekend. So they should do something with a veteran. You know, we have almost 350,000 veterans here in Massachusetts. Everybody knows somebody who's a veteran. So here's some things you can do over the weekend, because it isn't just Veterans Day weekend. Today is National Cappuccino Day, so you could call a veteran.
I had a cappuccino today. I didn't even know.
Saturday is go to an art museum day, so you could take a veteran there. Marine Corps birthday is Saturday. Sunday, yep. National Vanilla Cupcake Day is on Sunday. You could take a veteran to a bakery.
Although it would have been great if that had been the same day as National Cappuccino Day.
Yes, combined. Monday the 11th is National Sunday Day.
It's
a little cold, but definitely worth doing. If you know somebody who's single, it's Singles Day on Monday as well. But really, we should all thank our veterans for all that they've done for our country. We have a great country because of the people who put themselves on the line.
Excellent. Susan, what's your hubbub?
Well said. I'm going to focus on the Doyle's closing, but I'm going to focus on Wednesday, the day after the election, there was an auction. And for those of you who are not able to go or purchase a little slice of Doyle's life, the Boston Public Library and the JP Historical Society were there cataloging everything to make an online gallery so that they can live forever in history.
Oh, that's excellent. So even though everything's sold, there will be sort of this digital gallery of the paraphernalia from Doyle's and Jamaica Plain.
Yeah, I love that.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay, so for me, listeners, I think at this point have realized that, sadly, I am a huge fan of the ham on the lamb moments and things like police brought, you know, the escaped animal, the animal escapade, et cetera. Yeah. So one of our producers, Walter Wuthman, sent me an email earlier this week and said, I think this is your hubbub. And when I saw it, I said, oh, I think so. And this was this was the drowning deer. All right. So according to the Boston Globe, on Monday, Maine lobsterman Wren Dorr and his colleagues found a deer struggling in the ocean, 5 miles off the Maine coast, in the middle of the water, 5 miles off the coast. Not surprisingly, they were surprised when they saw a set of antlers in the water. So they fished the deer out. The deer had no explanation, clearly, for what it was doing there. They drove the deer back to shore, where it jumped in the water, walked back onto land, and immediately began snacking, because so would I after a long swim. So, well done to the crew of Maine Lobstermen. As for the deer, dude, I don't know what you were doing, but maybe stick to the land. But this is my new ham on the lamb.
There we go.
All right. Thanks for staying with us for Week in Review this week. Susan Tracy, Democratic strategist and president of the Strategy Group.
Thanks.
Also working with tobacco-free kids.
Thanks.
In support of a flavor ban on nicotine products.
You bet.
And Richard Tesse, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate. Thanks to you
nice.
As well.
Nice to see you.
All right, stay with us. Coming up, we make a trip to the Old North Church, where new research shows that some of its earliest funders were slave traders. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
Go ahead. Again, hold on.
Okay.
Take your time.
This is very narrow.
Yes.
We're climbing a tiny stairway into the steeple of the Old North Church. It was here, on a dark night in 1775, that most famous of the Boston Revolutionaries warned his comrades that the British were coming.
So Paul Revere did stand in this room. When he was 15 years old, he was one of the first bell ringers at Old North. And it's not an exaggeration to imagine that his familiarity with this steeple, with how incredibly large it loomed in the city skyline, such as it was, made this the perfect place for the signal lanterns to be held. So he was thinking years
ago. But underneath us, on the church floor, there are clues to a darker history behind this physical icon of American independence. We traveled to Old North Church recently to talk with Catherine Matthews, the co-director of education at Old North Church and Historic Site, about these new revelations. And we sat in the box pew that one Captain Newark Jackson used to own.
What we found out about Captain Jackson was that he, on his last voyage, the voyage during which he was murdered during a mutiny, he had been carrying enslaved individuals. Specifically, he was carrying enslaved children.
You first got an inkling of that in a researcher's book, but then Old North Church sought more research actively. Is that right?
In Jared Hardesty's first book, Unfreedom, he referenced Newark Jackson. At that point, our knowledge of him was extremely limited. When we first were considering talking about Jackson in our interpretive programming, we did look into his background. And aside from the mutiny, we didn't find anything in particular. He was a rather unknown individual. He was nothing special.
He was murdered on his ship.
Yes,
in a
he
mutiny.
Was in a mutiny. And so when Jared's book came out, our executive director read it, said, whoa, you know, Newark Jackson, familiar name. He invited Jared to speak. That began a relationship when Jared spoke here at Old North, and then we asked him, could you look into this more? Could you do more? And he did. And he started to research. His research was painstaking. It was worldwide. It was intensive. He found things over the course of 2 or 3 years, if not longer, that changed the course of our interpretation.
Did you suspect that this darkness, this evil part of his history, was there?
Well, we found out initially that he owned enslaved individuals, and that was not shocking because there was slavery in Boston. And among the wealthier classes, that would not be uncommon, but we did not anticipate the turn that the research took.
Is Jackson the only historic parishioner who engaged in slave trafficking, or are there others? Do you expect to find more stories?
Well, one of the things that even we as staff learned the night of our panel discussion was that Jackson was part of a group that were involved in smuggling and therefore involved in slave trading, and they had connections to this church. So we know that some of the money that went to build the first steeple came from these sources.
The steeple.
We know that money for the bells came from similar kinds of trade and people.
So how did you, as a community here at Old North Church, begin to reconcile this proud piece of American history that was rooted in freedom and American independence with the realization that there were parishioners here who were creating a complete lack of freedom and independence for other human beings? How do you grapple with that contradiction?
That's exactly what we do every day here. We look at the stories, all of the stories, whether they are stories of Revere and the Patriots or whether they are stories that show our darker side of our nation and how it was developing. We believe very strongly that we have to tell a comprehensive history. And yes, there are facts that are very, very, very hard to hear, but that does not mean you walk away from them. It means that you include them.
Since you got this research, you've learned these new truths. Have you reached out either to the African-American community in Boston about that, or have you considered trying to find descendants of any of the slaves that Jackson traded?
So this is the beginning of the process. We'll start there. And to the second point, it is very difficult, and it is a tragic fact of history that very often those voices are the ones that we do not have records of. That said, one of the things that we're committed to is as much as possible finding out the stories of the Black congregants that we have some records of and to research them further. Unfortunately, tragically, enslaved individuals there was a certain degree of anonymity.
Erasure.
Yes, yeah. Erasure is a perfect word.
We associate the North End so much with immigration.
Yeah.
With Italian immigrants, Jewish immigrants. There is a long history of African Americans in this area,
yes,
as well. Prince Hall, the African American abolitionist who was considered the founder of Black Freemasonry, is, yep, buried at Copps Hill Burying Ground. Mm-hmm. Does the history of Black congregants go all the way back to the founding of the church?
Goes back to the very, very beginning of the church.
Is that surprising?
No, I don't believe it's surprising, though I will say that I have learned since I've taken this job so much more that I was not aware of from my American history classes. We know that the North Gallery, right up there.
It's like a balcony.
It's like a balcony, was where Black congregants, whether they were free or enslaved, were sitting. To our best knowledge, they sat on benches, and northern exposures are brutally cold. It's still cold up there, even now. So they were the least comfortable seats by far.
So now the church, both as a congregation and as an historical institution, has decisions to make, mm-hmm, about what to do physically with this reality, with the markings of Jackson and, mm-hmm, other people engaged in slave trafficking, with that steeple, with nameplates. There's a chocolate shop, mm-hmm, that is a sort of a supporting business of Old North Church, mm-hmm, with Captain Jackson's name.
Mm-hmm.
What decisions do you make now about how to handle the physical markings that help draw traffic and contributions, et cetera, but have this history?
Well, this is going to be the focus of a tremendous amount of work as we go forward. Right now, we've been rewriting our scripts that our educators deliver to our visitors. We have been training our educators and our staff. We have been looking at exactly what you've noted, all of the signage that we have, and determining what needs to be changed, what needs to be made more accurate, what is the best way to ensure that we're telling the story throughout the entire site. And it is an entire site story, because while the chocolate demonstration pertains specifically now to the Jackson name, what we learned is that this entire church historically had connections to this trade. So it's a far more comprehensive project for us, and it will be a project that takes us time to do right and time to do with appropriate conversation communally.
I'm imagining that there's a continuum of views on this, mm-hmm, from don't do anything differently to it's all got to go. How do you think about where the appropriate place to land on such a continuum is?
So we tell the truth. We tell the comprehensive truth. The only limitation truly is making sure that we find an approach that the visitors can understand and absorb in the limited amount of time that they're with us.
Do you feel like there's anything you've learned from this process that would be useful to the other cultural and historic institutions in Boston that either are grappling with their history of slavery and racism now or will be sometime in the near future?
I think that our commitment to being very transparent and to being unafraid to look ugliness in the eye has in some ways given us courage. Just go ahead and do it. You know, tell your truth. Tell your stories. It's only right that everyone's voice is heard. So with that in mind, go forth.
Do you think at any point there will be amends to be made?
I consider truth-telling to be the ultimate. I really feel that it is to, if we can restore some voice to people who've been unheard for so long, that is crucial. So we're going to start with telling our truth.
Is there a way for us to get to a point where we understand our history such that we can celebrate what is great about it while we fully embrace the responsibility for what is terrible about it?
I believe so. I believe that's our job. I think that history, it's not an either or, it's an and. We just keep adding the ands. And we accept them. and the beauty of studying history and the reason that historic sites are really important is that it offers us this moment to look back and accept the totality of our history and then to say, okay, here we are, and where do we want to be?
That was Catherine Matthews, co-director of education at Old North Church and Historic Site. And if you want to see photos from our visit to Old North Church, you can visit our website, radioboston.org. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.